Let me just start saying a little bit more about myself, because I never imagined in my youth I'd be standing talking to a church. You know, I have this label of scientist. I was a scientist. Well, I still am a scientist, but not in the practicing sense. I think my scientific training really was a wonderful benefit, because it then has allowed me to approach the whole issue of spirituality from a scientific perspective. And by that I don't mean, you know, doing research on brainwaves, etc. I mean the healthy skepticism of the scientific approach, the healthy skepticism which is not taking anything on faith, only when it coincides with what I understand, with my own experience, do I accept it. As the Buddha said, don't believe anything I've told you, only believe it when you know it's true for yourself. And then really don't have any need to believe it, because you know it. I rejected spirituality when I was a kid. When I was about 13, I was brought up Protestant, Church of England, and went through the process of confirmation, which really for me was a process of deconfirmation, when I realized the Nicene Creed wasn't just something you chanted in church, like a hymn or something. It was a creed. You were actually meant to believe it, to sign off on it, to become a fully fledged member of the Church of England. You had to sign off on this stuff. It's like, what? That was it for me. I told my parents I'd had it with church, and they were fairly liberal, and they said, fine, don't worry. And so I went to church occasionally for weddings and odd things like that, but that was it. I was done with religion. And then, but I was always interested in the mind, consciousness. I was always interested in that through my teenage years, through college. And I got to the stage in university in physics where I could solve Schrödinger's equation for the hydrogen atom, which is meaningless to probably nearly all of you unless you've done advanced physics. But it's fascinating. It just means from pure mathematics you can start deducing hydrogen and the chemistry of hydrogen. Absolutely fascinating. And then it occurred to me, you know, the universe began with hydrogen, or began before that, but then hydrogen was the first element which evolved into all these other elements, which evolved into all this chemistry, which evolved into simple cells, which evolved into beings, which evolved into me here, there, doing the mathematics of hydrogen. And this struck me as really fascinating and weird, that here I was, a product of the evolution of hydrogen, able to think and be aware and study hydrogen. Absolutely fascinating. The universe has sort of come full circle in terms of knowing itself. And over the years I've come to see that that is, if there's any function to the universe, it is to know itself. The cosmos is a field of knowing, knowing itself more and more deeply, more and more fully. And we are at this time in history where we are knowing the universe from the outside. We're reaching the point where probably coming to a unified field theory, understanding everything, maybe, we don't quite know, we're looking back in time to the beginnings of the universe, looking out to the edge of the universe, looking down into the fine structure of matter. And the one place we haven't really looked yet is in here, into the mind, into human consciousness. That's the real bit of knowing that we are beginning to do at this point in time on this planet. And that's what struck me back then, was this is the real field of exploration, is consciousness, understanding consciousness, understanding how we come to be able to do things like study hydrogen, study the universe, and even study ourselves. But there was going to be nothing in physics that would help me there. Physics wasn't interested in this. So I thought I'd study philosophy, and I realized at Cambridge, the study of philosophy was just really the study of dead philosophers, and I wanted to, you know, do philosophy, get my sort of mitts into it. So I then did psychology. I did experimental psychology, neuroscience as it's called now. Learned an awful lot about the brain and memory and chemical processes and all this stuff. And no one was interested in consciousness. It was sort of hardly mentioned during the whole degree program. Consciousness, they weren't interested in it. And then I realized the way you study consciousness is not by studying the brain, putting electrodes on it, or dissecting the brain, or doing experiments on a person. All you're studying is the physical world still. The people who really study consciousness are the people who've sat down and observe their own minds. And that's the way you study consciousness, is by observing your own consciousness. We are conscious beings. And so I got involved in meditation, started getting involved in TM initially, Transcendental Meditation. And that took me out to India. This was back in the late 60s, early 70s. I was part of that whole movement. I got in my VW van and drove from London to India. That was quite a trip. And beautiful. Places like Iran, Afghanistan were wide open. Oh. And then spent some time in the Himalayas, Rishikesh, other places. I was with Maharishi for a while, studying with him. And that was really a turning point for me. Because first of all, I realized there was something to spirituality. Not necessarily to religion. For me, I always see, and as many people do, spirituality and religion are wide apart. It's like religion for me is sort of the dead embers of the fire. And spirituality is that fire. What is it that really gave life to all the different religions? And that's what I became fascinated by. I realized there was a common core to all the spiritual traditions. There was something similar there. But it was covered up, been covered up by centuries of time where things had been misunderstood or mistranslated or absorbed by a certain culture with its existing belief systems. And so when we look around the world today, we see a whole range of different religions, completely different religions. You look at the difference between, you know, Hinduism and Christianity or Buddhism and Taoism, totally different. And yet I realized they were all pointing towards the same thing. And that was to do with human consciousness and how we live in a very limited mode of awareness. We can call it a sort of egocentric mode, a materialistic mode. There's various ways we can frame it, but they're all pointing to the fact we limit our full potential. And they are all, in one way or another, have developed practices, techniques to open up that potential again, to allow us to discover who we really are. And that, if anything, is the underlying theme, I think, of all the world's traditions, is who are we? Or more, who am I? That whole question of what does it mean to even say the word I? What does it mean to be a conscious being? And also realizing that this was the one thing that was really critical for the world today. Because even then, 40 years ago, it was clear that we were heading into the biggest crisis this species had ever experienced. And now it's much, much more apparent that we are really in a state of crisis. And as I looked at it, almost every aspect of that crisis comes back in one way or another to human consciousness, to human thinking, to human decisions, to human values as to what's important. And yet whenever we're faced with a problem, we don't look to what it is in our consciousness that's behind the problem. We look out there to how can we solve the problem? How can we mend the environment? How can we make the bankers behave better? Whatever it is. How can we stop people polluting? We're not we think they're the problems. They're not the problems. They are the symptoms of a much deeper problem, which is a problem of human consciousness that affects us all in one way or another. We all get trapped in this very limited, short-sighted mode of consciousness, and our whole culture encourages it. Almost everything in our culture feeds this egocentric, materialistic mode of consciousness. As Emerson said, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, society, you have to excuse his gender language here, he said, society is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. I would rephrase that. Society is in conspiracy against the true essence of every one of its members. I mean, almost everywhere you look, everything is telling us, do this, get this, buy this, experience this, and you will feel better. Every bit of advertising you ever see, in one way or another, is saying, there's something missing. And you can feel better if you get this. We know what's missing, we'll give it to you. We'll give it to you. Whether it's, you know, a better credit card rate, whatever, you will feel happier. When they're right on one thing, that all we actually want is to feel happier, to feel better. That's the basic motivation of every single being. We want to feel okay inside. But we are conditioned by our society into this belief that we will feel okay if we get something or avoid something. And it works a bit. It works a bit. You know, we buy something, we feel a little better, and we think it's the buying it that's made us feel better. You know, you go and buy a new jacket. Something, you've seen it and you like the style or whatever and you want it, and you buy it and you feel better. And so you think it's the buying of something that's made you feel better. It seems to reinforce it. But what's actually happening is we've created a sense of lack, a sense of discontent, which is overshadowing our natural state of contentment. I believe the mind in its natural state is content, is at ease. We don't need to go anywhere to find ease, to be at peace. The mind in its natural state is at ease. But what the advertising tells us is no, no, no. You get ease by getting something. So we buy the jacket, we feel better. What's really happening is we've created a sense of dis-ease, a sense of discontent, a sense of lack in ourselves. And then when we buy something, we no longer have that particular discontent to worry about. So we feel okay again. We think the jacket's made us feel okay. It isn't. We've just returned back to our natural sense of ease and contentment. And one of the things I love about the internet is it's making this apparent. Because now, you know, you buy your jacket online. So you go to all the websites, you compare it, you compare the prices, and you look at everything, and you check the colors and all that, and you finally decide, this is the one I want, and you press that little button which says, buy now. And you feel better. The jacket isn't coming for another 3 days. That's the point you should feel bad because your credit card is now debited. But it's interesting because the point you feel better is the point you've eased that sense of discontent. You no longer have that lack to bother you. And so you feel okay again. The jacket comes and you realize, well, that wasn't quite the shade it looked like on the screen. And you're back into discontent again. So our society is continually, in many, many ways, trying to keep us in this. It's almost in a state of hypnosis that we're in from the the moment we're born, really. And it's part of our education, it's part of our upbringing, it's part of our culture. But what's important today is, I think we are collectively waking up from this. It's a collective awakening that's happening on the planet. That's never, ever happened before. And that's partly because of the telecommunications, the internet. We today have access to all of the world's spiritual traditions. And in the past, we can look back and, you know, we can read what people in India were writing 3,000-4,000 years ago, or other cultures in China. You know, 200-300 years ago, your only spiritual input probably was your local priest, if that was indeed spiritual input. Today, we are in a totally different situation. And it's coming at a time when we really, really need it. As I said, you know, the essential crisis is the crisis of consciousness. What is needed today is, and what is happening, is a global awakening of consciousness. And I've been fascinated by this in my own journey, because it was, say, back in the late 60s when I got interested in spirituality, went off on my own journey to India, had my own little awakening. It was, people sometimes say to me, you know, what was it that woke you up? And there was nothing really. It was like it was a seed in me which gradually grew and got watered and grew over time, and it's still growing. If I give this talk in 3 years' time, it'd be totally different. It's always, always growing, always developing. Back then, you know, we heard about these words enlightenment and all this stuff and all these enlightened people and gurus. And I think so many of us back then had this wonderful, glorified idea of what enlightenment was about. Like it was like this incredible new world, new experience, and some glorified acid trip or something. And we all had all these visions of what it was going to be, and went off chasing gurus and chasing experiences, and how high could you get, and could we get as high on meditation as we got on acid? And all this was sort of the thinking at the time. It's like we were chasing something, we were after something, we were trying to get somewhere, some new, wonderful, enlightened, glorious state of consciousness where we'd all be seeing angels the whole time, or whatever. And then we moved into a phase of, you know, doing workshops. There was the EST phase and moving into therapy, and we're like bringing it back home, really. You know, it's actually stuff we need to do. There's inner work. It's not just about chasing experiences. There's inner work we need to do in this waking up process. And over the years, we've been gradually honing our understanding of what spiritual awakening is about. And this is what is fascinating to me. This is the first time it's ever happened on this planet. In the past, spiritual movements have started because one individual has woken up, either through grace, through deep practice, through having a wonderful teacher, who knows, but an individual has awoken and they've been so enthralled by the shifts in their life, in the abundance of love and compassion and a total different way of living, that this has become so important. They've obviously wanted to teach it to other people, which they've done, and they've had their followings, and it's become a particular school or religion. And this has happened thousands and thousands of times on the planet. Most of them just we've forgotten about, and we know the ones that really lasted. But it's happened again and again and again. What's happening today is different. It's not there is one individual global leader who's got it, who's telling everybody what it is. There are thousands, millions of us, we are all teachers. We're all teaching each other, and we're all learning together. It's a collective awakening that is happening that was never, ever possible before. And as I say, it's partly through the communications that we have, that we can listen to tapes from somebody talking India. We can watch people giving workshops on the internet. We have this access to the information. And as we all learn from each other, two things happen. One, we begin to hone the truth together. We're beginning to come to a single common understanding of what it is about, the spiritual journey. And as we do that, what fascinates me is it gets simpler and simpler and simpler. And it's no longer about chasing these incredible experiences or, you know, maybe if I did this practice for 40 years and really worked at it really hard, I might get somewhere this lifetime. If not, then, you know, there's another three or four lifetimes I might really get there. It's really about doing the opposite. It's about letting go. Diane mentioned my new course, How to Meditate Without Even Trying. What I really have been teaching a lot recently is we have to let go of all effort, all trying. It's the actual trying, it's the wanting, it's the expectation which gets in the way of us actually realizing what we actually are. And I'll come back to that in a minute, this whole question again of who am I? But we are coming to this common understanding. I was giving a talk a while back, and at the end of the talk, this person stood up and he said, Dr. Russell, he said, what is it you are saying that's different from what everybody else is saying? And my response was, nothing, I hope. Because if I'm saying anything different, that's where I'm wrong. We are all saying the same thing in slightly different words, different metaphors, different examples, but the differences are getting less and less and less. So a whole new spirituality is appearing through us on the planet at this time. And when that happens, when you have a collective learning where we are all learning from each other, when you have that sort of feedback in its system, you have acceleration. Positive feedback in physics, engineering, always leads to acceleration. So we have an acceleration of awakening happening. And it's fascinating that we have this acceleration of awakening happening. At the same time, we have this whole acceleration in science, this acceleration in technology. You know, you now have to update your system every year. Soon it'll be every 6 months, every 3 months. If it's Firefox, it's every 6 weeks. Everything is going faster and faster and faster. And at the same time, we are heading into crisis faster and faster and faster. And at the same time, there is this collective awakening happening faster and faster and faster. All three trends are coming together. And I've no idea how that's going to look. It's a unique time in human history. We are heading into a time where we will have technology that today we cannot even imagine. And go back 200 years. If you'd shown Mozart this little tiny thing made out of a material he's never actually seen before, it's not wood, it's not metal, who knows what it is, this funny material, and you stick this thing in your ear and you hear a concert in high fidelity, it's like, you know, he'd have probably thought he was dreaming, and if you kept pinching him, he'd have said, this is magic. Whatever technologies we're going to have in the future will be like magic compared to what we know now, in terms of what we can do. We can only think in terms of our present technology. It's going to be magic what we can do in a world that is going to need magic. It's going to need completely new thinking approaches. We will no longer be able to approach things the way we've done in the past. It's going to need completely free thinking, completely new way of approaching things. It's going to need a complete liberation of consciousness in order to deal with the problems. And that's happening at the same time, and that's what gives me hope, is these three trends converging. As I say, I've no idea how it's going to look, but I know which team I'm playing on. Yeah. And we're all playing on the same team here, which is lovely. And in this honing, I say it's getting simpler and simpler and simpler. And it comes back to that question of, who am I? What does it mean to be a conscious entity? What is consciousness? It comes back to these fundamental questions. And science is at a loss to know how to deal with this. Science doesn't know how to explain consciousness. It cannot deny consciousness. And the one thing we all know for certain, the only thing we absolutely know for certain, is that we are aware. We can doubt everything else. We could even doubt we are sitting in this room. You know, we could all be plugged into the Matrix, for those who've seen the Matrix. We could be plugged into some incredibly 3D, high fidelity, surround sound, high resolution, touchy feeling, virtual reality. This may all be a created world we're living in. In some senses it is. We would still be conscious. We would still be aware. It's what is always there. There's never a moment in your whole life when you have not been aware. What you've been aware of changes from one moment to another. You go to sleep, you're no longer aware of the outside world much. But you have dreams, you're aware of your dreams, you're still aware, you're still conscious, you're conscious of something different. You go into deep meditation, you have a different sort of awareness, maybe there's a stillness, there's nothing really happening. But you're still aware. That is always there, that being aware. And that's the one thing that science cannot explain and it cannot deny. And part of the reason is that it's looking for something called consciousness. It's interesting, when you add any SS to any word, you turn an adjective into a noun in order to talk about it. But I sometimes like to say, there's no such thing as consciousness. There's no such thing as consciousness. Consciousness is not another thing to be known, to be aware of, to be defined, to be discussed. It is in awareness that all the knowing, the defining, the discussing, the thinking, the believing happens. It is what we are. What we are is conscious. It's not we are consciousness. When we say I am consciousness, that's actually wrong. We are saying I am something different. Consciousness. No. What I am is consciousness. I am conscious. That's the fundamental, I am conscious. And that leads back into the whole question of, you know, who am I? What am I? That question, which, you know, is above the gates in Delphi, it's come up in so many spiritual traditions. It's the path in some religious traditions, that exploration of who am I? And the way that's normally approached is, you know, oh, who am I? I am. Well, first of all, you know, I am Peter Russell. Now, that's obviously not true, because that's just my name. I could change my name. Some people do change their names. You haven't changed. You know, okay, I am British. Well, I'm no longer British. I'm now half American. So That's changed. But I haven't changed. You know, I have my history, my values, all of that stuff, my personality, my character. That could all have changed, but that sense of I is always the same. It's interesting, we sometimes say, you know, I am not the same person I was 20 years ago. If you think about that, it's interesting. There's two I's in there. I am not the same person I was 20 years ago. There's the person I was, which is maybe the personality, the beliefs, the values I had, the things I liked, the things I didn't like. Those are all the things that we identify with. Those can all change. But that feeling of I-ness, that feeling of beingness, hasn't changed at all. How it feels to be you, in essence, is exactly how it felt to be you, in essence, when you were 10 years old, or 5 years old, if you can remember back that far. That essence never, ever changes. And you cannot define it. And that's why so many teachings point to the fact you cannot define the I. In fact, the I doesn't exist in a way. The I is not a thing either. Just as consciousness is not a thing, the I is not a thing. We delude ourselves when we start looking for what am I? Am I this? Am I that? And all we end up with is a lot of ideas and beliefs and statements about what I am, all of which distract us from actually being aware of what we mean by I. And what we mean is this sense of pure beingness, which is totally familiar. It's so, so familiar. We all know it absolutely, what we mean by I, but we cannot define it. And it's the defining it that is actually wrong, that takes us off. And that feeling of being, that feeling of meanness, I-ness, beingness, so familiar, it's actually also totally impersonal. It's not personal at all. If I take away everything that's Peter Russell about me, if I woke up this morning with no memories of my life, nothing at all, nothing, no past, no idea of a future, no idea of who I am, what I'm doing, what is this thing called a, what is it? I don't. If everything was wiped out, I might be totally puzzled, but the I that would be puzzled would be the same I. It would, but it would have no qualities, no individual qualities. And if the same happened to you, that I that woke up in you would be the same quality, the same sense that I have. And it's in that sense that I think we are the most deeply united. That sense of beingness, which is this, the experience of being conscious, that sense of deep being I-ness is the same for each and every one of us. And that is, I think, the most fundamental level at which we are all one, at which we are all united. And that is the realization which is creeping into this culture at this time. And this, I think, is what all the great teachers have been pointing towards in one way or another. Whenever you see a statement, I see a statement from any tradition which says, you know, I am this, I am the light. It's not I, Peter Russell, am the light, but it's that quality of beingness is the light of consciousness in me. That is the light of the world. That is the light that is actually experiencing this world, is that beingness in myself. Be still and know that I am God. Be still. Let the mind be still. Step back from experience and know that that sense of amness, that sense of beingness, is the divine essence in myself. For me, everything starts making new sense. I am love. Yes, we can see that as how I am in the world. But also when we drop all the thinking, the sense of a separate self, the ego, when all that drops away, what you discover, as we were just hearing earlier, is that love that is not the romantic love, but is just that love which is our true nature. Our true nature is love, because our true nature knows we are all deeply, fundamentally connected. Ramana Maharshi said, "I am is the name of God. God is none other than the self." That I am is the name we give to God. I would turn it the other way around and say, God is the name we give to I am, to our sense of beingness. Even Schrödinger, the quantum physicist, whose wave equation set me off on this journey, said, this wonderful little book, he said, what is the self? Who am I? He said, on deep introspection, and notice the word he said, introspection, not deep thinking, not deep understanding, but introspection, looking into yourself, observing yourself. On deep introspection, you'll discover that what you mean by I is the foundation upon which all experiences happen. It's that which is always there. Whatever your experience, there's always this sense of beingness, this sense of me-ness that's always there. And this, I say, is what I think what all the traditions are pointing to, is the recognition of that. And the recognition that wherever we are, whatever we're doing, any day, we can just pause and just recognize that sense of beingness, which is always present, never changing, just there, that stable light that is always there in us. Maybe I've said enough. How are we doing for time? There's a little time. Actually, I feel like finishing with something that you've all heard before, most of you, I'm sure. It's a poem. It was actually from a play, from Christopher Fry's play, A Sleep of Prisoners, which he wrote during the closing days of the Second World War, which Sir George Trevelyan, a great English spiritual leader who's no longer with us, great orator, great poetry reader, made popular, and Jean Houston's made it even more popular. And I closed my video, The Global Brain, with it. And it's one of these things that is, there's so much in it, it's so powerful. The human heart can go the length of God. The human heart can go the length of God. Dark and cold we may be, but this is no winter now. The frozen misery of centuries cracks, begins to move. The thunder is the thunder of the flows, the thaw, the flood, the upstart spring. Thank God our time is now. when wrong comes up to meet us everywhere. Never to leave us till we take the greatest stride of soul folk ever took. Affairs are now soul size. The enterprise is exploration into God. But where are you making for? It takes so many thousand years to wake, but will you wake for pity's sake? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So we take a little time for questions? Because I know everybody's got lots of them. You've all been stopping me all along for the week, so now's your chance for a few other questions. Yes. On the surface, we are confronted by a whole range of crises. It's what the Club of Rome called the global problematique, a whole set of interconnected things. It's population, it's using up the resources, running short of oil, it's climate change, it's pollution, there's economic crises, there's social crises, there's so many different things coming together where systems are breaking down, we are running out of time, we're running out of resources, or we're destroying the environment. There's a whole set of things which are happening in the world. That's the surface of the crisis, which we read about in the newspapers, see on the news every single day in one way or another. You could say the news is all about documenting the crisis. And what I'm saying is we need to look deeper and ask, why is it we are allowing this to happen? What is in our consciousness that actually is behind this? But was that getting at your question? Okay, great. Yeah. Did you want to give them a mic? So, yeah. Back there, first of all, the guy grinning in the light.
Thank you, Peter. The question, there's three, but pick the one you feel most inspired to.
Oh, lovely. You usually say, I want all of these three answered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, one is, so the I, it's a question. The I, when I say I, is God versus ego. That's one.
Mm-hmm.
The other is, there are authors now who are on the New York Times best-selling list who are atheists. And we know, and they're promoting atheism. And scientists are imaging the brain and seeing the God experience in certain parts of the brain. So the question, and they're looking for, how can we pinpoint the I in the brain?
Mm-hmm.
And then third, cloning. How is it possible? It looks like eventually we'll be able to clone a person. And how is that possible, being an expression of God, that we can clone out of a human being? So, whichever one you feel is fine.
I might sort of tackle all three together. Let's deal with the atheist first of all. I'm an atheist in the sense I do not believe in some almighty separate power out there that created everything and is looking over us, judging us, and deciding whether we're doing good or bad. All of that to me is a projection of the human mind. That's not the sort of God I'm talking about. And so that's the sort of God the scientific atheists are rejecting. know, they're saying, we've looked down into matter, we've looked out into space, we can't see God, God doesn't exist. The God they're rejecting is a very simplistic, naive view of the divine. So I have no problem with those atheists. They just throw the baby out with the bathwater, basically. They don't realize what God actually means. For me, God is the essence of everything. It is the essence of everything. And in that sense, it is the essence of me. And it is the essence of my experience. And so in that sense, the essence of my experience, as I've been saying, is this sense of I-ness. I wouldn't even like to use the word the I, because the I makes it a thing. But I cannot, if I look inside myself, as many people have done, I cannot find an I. Because the I that is trying to find an I is the I that is looking is the I. You know, there is always this sense of beingness, presence, which, as I even to put the word I on it, is actually a wrong label. If I'm being more accurate, I would say there is the quality of amming. There is a wearing. There is amming. It's a verb. It is always there. That's why we cannot define it. When we say the I, we are trying to make it a thing, define it as something different from ourselves. As soon as we say, I am this, however subtle it is, we are making it different from this very fundamental quality of beingness. But in making it different, in looking for something different, we make it a thing. And that's where the ego comes in. The ego is an identification with something else, whether it's on a superficial level of identifying with, you know, who we are in society, the roles we play, life history, whatever it is, our personality, or on a deeper level, it's that sense of agency, of being something in the world that actually makes decisions, carries out things. All of that is either ideas or experiences that are appearing in awareness, that we are aware of. So we can say, I have an ego, but the ego is not the I. The I is aware. Language, but you can be aware of an ego in yourself, but it's the you that is aware of it I am pointing to. And that, I'm saying, is the same for every being, every conscious being. Now, cloning, yes, you can clone a biological being. We could take a cell from you and produce another you, much younger you, grow it up. It would be identical biologically, have the same biological traits and weaknesses and gifts and all of that. It would have a different history. Even if you take two cells and clone them at the same time, they're going to grow up eventually with different histories. They are going to develop different personalities, different egos, different individuals, exactly the same biologically. So their egos will be different, but each of them, their essence will be the same. That will not have changed. That is the same for every being, that essence. And that's what unites us. Jim.
Oh,
is another Jim? Which Jim?
I was quite taken by this movie a few years ago. It's called What the Bleep.
Yeah.
And some of my colleagues and I, we were excited because it seemed like that finally science and metaphysics and mysticism were coming together. Then I was talking to a scientist and he said, whoa, wait a minute. don't get caught up. If you take too many liberties, you'll be performing metaphysical malpractice, and that a lot of the science and what we're saying in metaphysics, you're making some incorrect assumptions. And I was hurt by that because I was excited about what to believe, you know? And just saying, yay, we're going to be moving forward. Can you give some insights in, because you have an idea about metaphysics and you have an idea of quantum physics. Are there some really good correlations that we can make, or should we be cautious and when we start to say, ah, science has proven what Charles Fillmore said back in 1901? Just give me some insight.
Yeah. I'm sorry to say I would side with your friend. I think we have to be very cautious. There are certainly parallels between what modern physics, particularly quantum physics, is discovering and what all the great sages have discovered about human consciousness. There's many parallels there. And there may be a deeper underlying reason for those parallels. I think, though, because we live in this material world that is questioning everything, it comes back to that Emerson quote, you know, our whole society is a conspiracy against the wisdom that we know inside. We know it inside, and we live in a world that doesn't know it. And when science comes along and it says, ah, here's something, science is supporting what I know is true. Oh, here science is supporting what I know is true. We grab at it. And I think we may be sometimes mistaken in grabbing at it. We want science to support us, to support our knowing, so that the rest of the world, you know, oh, have you seen What the Bleep? It proves what we know is true. You know, and I think so many people, when they saw What the Bleep, they wanted all their non-spiritual friends to see it, to convince them that this is what I've been trying to tell you all the time.
Right.
Yeah. I would say we have to be cautious. I would encourage us all to rely upon our own knowing, what we know to be true, and talk from that. Because if we rely too much upon the parallels with science, we may find ourselves getting tripped up at times. There's one back there, there's several. And let's go this side of the room for.
If I understand correctly, the essence of what we are is our awareness. And we're aware that we're awareness. Could you comment on whether or not that necessarily says we're also free to make choices and the implications of that? And that how important is freedom?
Awareness. Phew.
In a word or two.
I should be finishing in a minute or two, and that's a whole other lecture. It's basically the question of free will. Yeah, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Let me give you the short answer. The ego experiences free will. The ego makes decisions, makes choices, and in its world there is free will. The pure self, the awareness, is the witness to the unfolding of that. It is not actually making choices. It is the witness to the unfolding. And that is free in a different sense, because the pure self is free from the machinations of the ego. It is not caught up in the emotions that the ego triggers. It is not caught up in the stories that unfold. It is eternally free in itself. It is not affected by all that goes on in awareness. So, yeah. That's the short version. Let's just take a couple more, and then I know we've got a few more things to do before we close.
In unity there right now, in the unity movement, there's an underlying, I do think there's an underlying sense of who we are regarding religion.
Mm-hmm.
We've come out of a form of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And we are looking at, are we Christian or are we still a form of Christianity because we have expanded, because of our acceptance of truths from other paths,
mm-hmm.
We have grown into where some of our ministries don't even talk about the Bible or Jesus that much. I have dialogued with a young man who is a very devout Muslim in where I live, and we have dialogued about. I've shared with him my form of Christianity. He shared with him his form of Islam, which is the Bible and the teachings, more or less are there to draw truth from you. It's not what's on the page coming at you. It's something that's coming from within you that connects with what's on the page. He says he feels the same way about the Quran, and that because of that, it holds great value for him and his practices. So do you see religion having any value in the individual's spirituality? And if so, I mean, is it good to ground ourselves in that while at the same time expanding beyond it?
Yeah. Let me replace religion by spiritual tradition.
I love it.
So is it valuable to have a spiritual tradition? Yes. And as it's a teacher, there's many forms of teaching, and spiritual traditions are one form of teaching. Some people just have an individual teacher. There's many forms of teaching. They are pointing us towards the truth. And I think the important thing is to be in our own search for what is that truth they are pointing towards, rather than getting hung up on the exact words that were used to point to it, because then we may misinterpret the words from the ego's point of view, rather than allowing the words to resonate with our own inner wisdom. There was one other question back there from, yes, right at the beginning. Who was it right at the beginning asked a question? No? Somebody? Then we should wrap up probably because you need, yeah.
Would you address the issue, if you can, in a few words, of our cosmology and how our cosmology informs our behaviors, and what in particular about your cosmology makes you who you are today?
And what do you mean by cosmology?
Your frame of reference.
Okay.
Total existence as you see it.
Yeah.
And how we can benefit from your experience of your existence.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Thank you. I had to go back and think, how would I define my cosmology? Let me just take one aspect of it. It comes back to what I was saying about how, in essence, we are the same. What it means for me, in the deepest sense of my own being, to be me, beyond anything personal, is the same as what it means for you. And our beingness is that it is at ease, it is at peace, it is love. That is where each of us wants to return to, is our own beingness, our own presence. That's where each and every one of us wants to return to. And we get distracted. We get caught up in things. And we get caught up in our emotions and our reactions and our story. And in all of that, we are looking to return to our essential natural state. if that is what each of us is seeking, then my philosophy is, not even philosophy, but my attitude is that is what we should be seeking to give each other, which is, to put it very simply, in any interaction I have with anybody, how can I interact in terms of whatever I'm saying or body language, whatever it is, how can I interact with you in such a way that you feel more at ease, more respected, more loved, whatever it is we are each looking for, that you are in your own way returning to your own presence, because that's what we all need. And that is, that's really the golden rule that's in every spiritual tradition. Treat other people as you would like to be treated. But that's often interpreted in a sort of external way. You know, be kind to other people, make sure, help someone cross the road, that sort of thing. Do nice things for them. Yes, that's great. But beyond all that is, it's more practice for myself. How do I interact with people so that I am taking out, if there's a slight sense of attack comes into my mind, to catch it. Because when I'm attacking somebody in my mind and it comes out in my speech, and it may just be in a slight choice of words or a slight edge or slight body language, as soon as I'm attacking somebody, I am deliberately trying to cause them harm, upset, pain. I am not looking after their inner well-being. And so the practice becomes that. And I'm, you know, I can do it sometimes. I'm learning. There's times when I fail miserably. But that is my intention, that in any interaction, how can I do this in such a way that the other person feels more at ease, they feel loved, respected, rather than harmed, diminished, judged, or criticized. Okay. I think we should probably, sorry, I know there's other questions, but I know we have a few more things to do before the session finishes, so I think we should close there. And I'm around. Thank you.
I'm still back with having three questions posed simultaneously and his just pausing. I think I'll do all of those at once. Okay, thank you, God. Thank you, Peter. Thank you for being who you are. And for also letting us know and giving us permission by the way you language that, that you are still in that emming process with yourself. Thank you for that.